Saturday, August 6, 2011 in Salt Lake City will be our next live show, and it will be hosted by the lovely Zilpha Larson.
Wait, I thought it was hosted by the fabulous John Larson.
Well, maybe we'll both be there. And this year, we're going to shake it up and do something different. This show is mostly a concert. We have five great bands who will be there, including...
That's right. We've got Shane Jackman, McCall Erickson, Kristen Erickson, Otter Creek, that's the Danzigs.
Peter and Mary.
We also have David Jorgensen.
There'll be live commentary and music, and our theme this year is...
Embracing uncertainty. So if you're not sure about if you want to go to the show or not, just embrace the uncertainty and go for it.
Tickets are available now if you go to mormonexpression.com/tickets. You can get your ticket there. The list price is $17. It'll be $22 at the door. But now, for a limited time, you can pay whatever price you think is decent. We have some sponsors who are helping pick up the tab and help pay the musicians and the sound guys and all that sort of stuff.
Yep. So it's a great opportunity to name your own price and go get your ticket.
There are a limited number of seats, and I know a lot of people are planning on coming and sort of putting off buying their tickets, so you want to make sure you get yours early so you can reserve your seat. There will also be some extra special guests showing up, personalities from the podcast and whatnot.
Yep.
And you get a chance to meet the lovely Zilpha Larson and her trollish husband. Okay, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. And tonight I'm here in studio with another great episode I've been looking forward to for a long time. And, you know, we've gotten a lot of questions over the past, it's been 2 years now. There's a few topics that really promote a lot of questions. And one of those is Freemasonry and Mormonism, which is a thread that comes up, and I think in the church today, we tend not to understand it. We tend to gloss over it, and we tend to say wrong things about mm-hmm. it and mix it up. So what we're going to try to do tonight is untangle the mess, and we're going to start at the beginning of Freemasonry. And tonight, I have my friend George Miller is going to walk us through Masonry. Welcome to Mormon Expression.
Thank you. It's very good to be here today. I've been looking forward to this. I'm a very big fan of Mormon Expressions. I hear that you haven't listened to all of the podcasts. I think I've got a one up on you. I've actually listened to all of them.
Yeah, you called me out. I have not indeed listened to every one of them, and you have. Well. I should defer to your expertise. Well, that's a badge of distinction. You should get something for that. All right, so you have a background both in the church and in Freemasonry, academically and otherwise. Let's first of all introduce yourself and why we should listen to you.
Okay. Sometimes I wonder if you should, but let me go ahead and give you a little bit about my background. So I was born in the Utah area, but moved out. Lived most of my life in the Midwest. So I guess, you know, the mission field. Grew up, you know, in a very active family. Still am active. I was the one in Sunday school who always had my hand up. Enjoyed, you know, growing up in the church. Went on a mission. Went to Japan. Went to BYU. Where I studied microbiology, actually, and graduated from there and moved out to the Missouri area and worked for a couple of years doing anti-cancer research.
Wow.
And enjoyed that. Then I went and moved with – actually got into grad school and at Washington University in St. Louis, followed my advisor down to Vanderbilt. And when I was down in Vanderbilt, got my PhD there in cell and developmental biology. And then after that, I'm actually right now up at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, where I study basic science research, studying a process that hopefully will extend lifespan.
Wow.
So that's kind of my academic career. As far as church, you know, after the mission, I became very, very interested in the temple. In fact, I was a temple worker in Provo. I was a temple worker in St. Louis. And I was a temple worker in Chicago when I spent a short stint up there working on an anti-biological warfare project.
Wow.
And so, you know, I would, you know, basically for 5 or 6 years after my mission, I was in the temple at least on a weekly basis. And it was really the interest in the temple that got me interested in masonry. I went through the temple. I actually had a good experience going through the temple. Probably why I went back so many times.
It's funny you say that almost apologetically.
Well, it's just I know so many people that have not had a good experience. And, you know, I had a good experience, but when I went through it, I was just going, why are we doing this here? Why are we doing that here? Why are, you know, it just did not make much sense to me.
Right, right. And I you know, on that note, I think 90% of the people have a bad experience do so because they're unprepared.
I think that's true.
It is a little different than what most people are used to, but they come in completely not knowing what's going to happen. And I think that lends to it.
I think you're right. And I wish there was a lot more education and preparation. And I think the secrecy issue is, you know, one that is interesting. It's interesting actually in Freemasonry. You know, there's also a certain level of secrecy. And however, if you actually ask around and talk to Freemasons, what they'll actually tell you is there's only a very, very select few things that cannot be discussed. And they basically all boil down to the secret passwords and the secret handshakes.
They still hold to that. I mean, I thought that all sort of been abandoned after Duncan's ritual, but they still hold to that, the secrecy?
They still hold to the secrecy. So usually when Freemasons talk about this type of stuff, they will talk about it. But like, if you were to ask me right now, you know, if Duncan's ritual was accurate, I would probably hum and haw and say, you know, there are lots. What we will usually do is actually say, so Freemasons are more than willing and happy to talk about exposés. And we'll talk intimately about them and say, well, look at this expose and look at this expose and look how all three of these say almost identical things. But actually, when you actually say, so is that what's going on today? We'll go,
that's funny because I just don't think of Freemasonry as being secret anymore. I guess, but I don't really read the trades or anything, so I don't follow it. You know,
no. The truth is, there's been so many exposés. I mean, literally, like the first exposé was, you know, within 5 or 6 years of the first Grand Lodge being formed in 1700. Actually in 1717. So there has been exposés upon exposés upon exposés upon exposés.
It's a fun thing to do, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Now, before we get into that history, which we'll cover in a little bit more detail here, but so now what is your relationship personally with the Freemasons?
Okay. That's a great question. So like I mentioned, it was, the temple ceremony that got me really interested because I was just always confused. You know, why are we doing this here? And so I started asking around, went online, and I actually got on a very interesting board that had a couple of Freemasons that, you know, had done a lot of research. And, you know, I'm like, well, how do I find out about Freemasonry? And one of the things they actually suggested was I pick up a copy of Duncan's Ritual. And in discussing with them, I became more and more enraptured and interested. And so I actually bought a couple of different exposés and started reading through them. And when I started reading, it was actually very tough. The Masonic ritual is a lot like the temple. You know, if somebody says, well, what do you do in the temple? You kind of go, I have no idea how to explain this. But, you know, after reading, you know, several exposés and spending, you know, literally going through them 5, 10, 15 times a piece, I actually, strangely enough, really found that I loved the ritual. And as I began to read other books that were like the philosophy of masonry and, you know, what goes on philosophically behind these things, I absolutely fell in love with the teachings. And although I never planned to become a Freemason, at a certain point I said, you know, I'm in love with this stuff. Why don't I join? So while I was doing my PhD, I went ahead and became a Mason down in Nashville, Tennessee. And I've continued to do that as I moved up to the Michigan area. I'm actually, so just as in with Mormonism, you have, you know, different ranks and callings and things like that. Masonry is usually in the same way that Mormonism is. You have groups of three. So you have your president and your first and second counselor. I am currently the next in line to become the, what's known as the Worshipful Master, which is the head of the lodge in the Ann Arbor 262 where I attend.
Wow. You know, a lot of what you said has resonated with me. I read a couple of books, not as many as you have. I mean, I think I've said on the podcast before, I got a copy of Duncan's Ritual when I was quite young, and I can't remember if I did it on my mission or before my mission. And it wasn't anything that negatively impacted my testimony at all. And we were talking last night. And to me, it helped me understand the temple ceremony. So it was one of those. And I've recommended it to several people since, you know, as a faithful member. And, you know, you should really get it yourself a copy and flip through it and sort of understand the connection. And you know, I read a couple of the mainstream books like Born in Blood and that mm-hmm. and those. And I can't memorize things very well, and I don't have a lot of free time. But I've wanted to experience the you know, 'cause I can read about them. I can see the pageantry and the ritual. But my guess is there's nothing like experiencing it.
In many, same way as with the endowment, you know,
right.
Really experiencing it is very different than reading about it. As far as my other research, so I've been reading and studying about this for about the last 10 years. And I actually belong to two research societies, one of those being the Scottish Rite Research Society. I'm actually a 32nd degree Freemason in the Scottish Rite. And one of the things I actually focused in on was, as I began to study Masonic history, was the fact just as Mormonism has radically evolved since, you know, the 1820s, 1830s on, the church back then is very different than it is today. And so one of my personal interests in Masonic history has been actually to go back and look at what Masonry looked like in Joseph Smith's time from about, you know, 1810 to about 1870. And, you know, that has given me a brilliant view of what was probably going through Joseph Smith's mind. And I like what you said here about actually reading about this stuff. Most people are like, I don't want to read that. You know, it'll really make me question my faith, etc. I actually have found that studying this stuff has given me insight into the endowment and what Joseph Smith was actually doing, and has actually very much deepened my understanding of the endowment and made it much more personal and meaningful. So I concur with your idea there.
Well, I'll use a simple example. I never went through a live session. Now, the live sessions, they still do at Manti and Salt Lake, where you move from room to room, mm-hmm. And they have actors. Everywhere else, you watch the standard film. Now, to signify the moving, especially from the, you know, the terrestrial, like to the the celestial to the terrestrial rooms, mm-hmm. They turn the lights on in the temple.
Yes.
Now, I had been to the temple probably 70 times before I ever went and saw a live session, and I never caught that detail. Mm-hmm. Because in the session, they never tell you. Now, when you move from room to room, it's obvious what's happening.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and they say, you know, you're now entering but it just always washed over me. So that's one of those things that, you know, it's not like it's wrong the one way and right the other way. It's a significant way to show that symbology of moving from darkness into lightness, but it was completely lost on me, and I'm not like a, you know, ignorant knave or anything. So once I saw it, it clicked right there. And I think there's lots of things like that that might be buried in there, but if somebody shows them to you, you're like, ah.
Yeah. And I think that's true. I mean, and that's what going through many of the Masonic rituals has helped me. You know, there's all these, and I'll say this, Joseph Smith placed many things in the endowment in such a way to remind the people that went through, who were, at least in Nauvoo, almost 100% of them were Masons. There are clues and little things hidden within the endowment ceremony that reference what's going on in the Masonic ritual. That once you understand the symbolism of the Masonic ritual, you can see what Joseph Smith is doing mm-hmm. in the endowment in ways that, you know, really deepen the experience.
All right. So when we talked about doing this recording, what we suggested that a lot of LDS people don't understand Masonry at all, just like the rest of the world. And there's a lot of bad information out mm-hmm. there. So we were going to start at the beginning.
Okay.
And go back. And so let's start first, before we talk about the history, you know, you mentioned the 1700s. What basically is, what is it all about? You know, we know, most people will know there's stonemasonry somewhere in there. There's the temple. There's Hiram Abiff. What's the basic narrative of the Masonic?
That's a really tough question. Let me actually go back and go back to something you said. You said you'd read Born in the Blood.
Yeah.
I would highly suggest that that is an extremely misleading book.
I read it years ago. I don't remember much about it, but
and actually, it's one of the most common books that non-Masons will read. It really is a very large piece of pseudo history.
And if I remember right, it's fairly antagonistic.
It is a little bit antagonistic. Fairly. And I would also suggest that, you know, things like Dan Brown's books are also incredibly misleading.
What?
Yeah, I'm afraid to tell you. So in answering that question, that's a little bit difficult question to answer. Let me answer it kind of in a slant ways way. I'm going to answer and say what it's not. Okay.
Okay.
Many Mormons are of the opinion that, you know, say I've heard through the grapevine that way, way back in the time of Solomon, there were Masons, and that they had a ritual, and that got passed down, you know, from 1000, is it 1000? Yeah, right around 1000 BC, and got passed all the way down through Freemasonry to the present. And that, you know, that's why there's similarities in what Joseph Smith revealed. Sorry to burst your bubble. That's just factually completely incorrect.
But that was something that was believed by Masons outside of Mormonism.
And really, I'm telling you a view of Masonry that is Masonry today. In Joseph Smith's time, almost everyone that was a Mason would have actually believed that things went all the way back to Solomon. And in fact, most Masons in Joseph Smith's day would have actually believed that Freemasonry went all the way back, not to Solomon, but Adam.
Which is part of the Masonic lore itself.
Oh, yes. It's definitely part of the Masonic lore. But that Masonic lore didn't exist in the early stonemason guilds. It actually develops over time. And as we talk about the history of Freemasonry, I'll talk about how the myth itself evolved and where those elements came from.
All right. So It obviously, Freemasonry, it was born out of the guilds.
It was born out of the guilds. Let me go ahead and back up one other second. Another thing I also want to, one of those myths I want to dispel. Sadly enough, there is no good evidence that the Knight Templar.
Oh, yeah, I was going to mention the Knight Templar. Because you could turn on the Discovery Channel any Saturday night and there'll be an expose that connects it. You know, from the Masonry guilds of the Middle Ages to the Knights Templar and back to the...
And then back into the Masons. Yeah. And the evidence for that is really pseudo-history. And I feel really bad because sometimes, you know, you'd love the History Channel to be accurate, wonderful history. But sadly, you know, for anyone that's a history major or really studied these things, they tend to go for the show value, and you know it's just not always that good.
Now my understanding, I'm not a really ancient historian, but passion plays and these sort of theatrical narratives, kind of like we have in the temple about the creation, these were common and different sort of ceremonies. So, for example, it is likely that the Knights Templar had secret signs and secret ceremonies and stuff like that. So, I mean, It's not a crazy connection. There's just no evidence suggesting this lineage.
There's no genetic connection. Right. And one of the things to remember here is almost every single one of the religious, you know, monks organizations or all these things, they all had ritual. They all had historical kind of passion play narratives. They all had all of these type of things. So to say, oh, well, this is something specific to Freemasonry is just really inaccurate. I mean, it's still accurate that they had it, but to suggest that, you know, something's being passed on through these passion narratives is just, you know, it's just not true.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think one of the things that's fascinating is that the Freemasonry rites have survived because all the rest of have died out.
Probably
would have been much more common. And I think we forget in this day of, you know, where we have laminated IDs from the state and credentials that, you know, in the Middle Ages and who knows how far back, the way you would establish your credentials, if be it a monk or whatever, is you have to know stuff.
Yeah.
You'd have to be able to recite big memorized texts or potentially know the secret passwords and hand signs. Mm-hmm. That's how you would know that you had actually achieved the rank that you were demanding pay for.
Yeah. So let me go ahead and – so those are the two things myths I want to dispel. Let me go ahead and answer the question of what Freemasonry is today. Many people are familiar with like the Elks Club.
Right.
Or the Aquinas Club or, you know, all of these different social organizations that are around. In many ways, Freemasonry is today a group like that. It's a place where men can go as a fraternal body and talk. They can get involved in their community. They can provide service. They can provide, you know, monetary help for those that need. And in many ways, that's really what it is. It's like a Rotary Club.
And it's still just men.
It's still just men. However, almost all Masonic groups also have what are known as like a female organizations that's usually connected to them that their wives or daughters, etc., can join.
But they don't go through any sort of rites or anything like that.
Actually, there's been rituals that are based on the Masonic rituals, though heavily modified. That those women's organizations go through.
And
that was also true in Joseph Smith's time as well.
And I don't want to like try to attack the Masons sort of followed the culture as far as race and, you know, those sort of discriminatory things, not discriminatory.
They most definitely did.
Yeah.
And so in early America, there was a lot of discussion. This would be like the 1800s, early to mid 1800s. There was lots of discussion on whether African Americans should be admitted. And what ended up happening was the African Americans formed their own Masonic guilds. It's called Prince Hall Masonry. And so for years, they have run their own Masonic bodies. However, within like the last, you know, 25 years, there's been much of a breakdown of that. We have African Americans in our lodge in Ann Arbor. We are very, very good friends with the Prince Hall Masons. We go visit their rituals. They come visit ours. You know, it's fully recognized as being them being as Masons. And so, you know, there has been those problems. And again, you know, that it still is a predominantly male organization. So.
And no atheists.
Oh, that is actually one thing that they do have. You cannot be an atheist and be a Mason. That has been a tradition, one of the things that was subscribed as law in, you know, 1425, that has continued on. And however, if you're a deist or your definition of God is extremely loose, for most lodges, that's perfectly acceptable.
Yeah, you know, we see all the time, of course, Discovery Channel and stuff, want to point out that a lot of the founding fathers were heavy Masons, and those guys weren't really strongly religiously tied.
No, they were very, very much deists.
And I've heard that there are, you know, Masons who are Buddhists and who are Hindu and all sorts of stripes. So
yeah, in fact, our lodge has stripes of all flavors, and that is one of the things that's probably, at least for its time, was one of Masonry's extremely strong traits.
Mm-hmm.
Freemasons, there's two things you cannot discuss in lodge. One is religion. The other is politics. And, it, you know, there's a feeling, it's really more a tenet of the craft, that we have to treat other religions equally. And in fact, if you look at Joseph Smith, it's about the time that he joins the Freemasons that a lot of his most classic statements on religious tolerance come out.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. In the Nauvoo period there. Okay. So let's go back in time. The evidence would suggest it really was born out of the Stonecutters Guild.
Most definitely. Now, if you were actually to go, so I'm actually going to take you back to about 1400.
Okay.
Is really how far we want to.
Because I was
really
going to ask about Wat Tyler.
Wat Tyler?
Yeah.
Oh, the Tyler.
Yes. We can get there in a minute.
Okay.
As far as I understood, that's the earliest controversial evidence of the Masons coming up. But Wat Tyler led the, and which of the English revolutions, but he has the name Tyler.
Yeah. I'm personally a bit skeptical.
You don't buy
about
into the Wat Tyler thing.
I really don't. So actually, I'm going to go back to about the 1400s.
Okay.
And what we're really looking at is in the 1400s, if you were to compare the Stonemasons Guild to any other guild, you know, the Carpenters Guild or any of this, exactly the same. There's absolutely nothing different between one guild and the other. There is, however, probably one small difference, and that is because Masons had to move from place to place. They did have instituted, it looks like even back then, secret handshakes and you know, code words that would allow you to move from one city or one building project to another, and those would allow you to be identified as a Mason. And it would also probably differentiate you between a entered apprentice or a fellow craft or, you know, a more experienced Mason.
So I'm a Mason on one site. The church or whatever I'm working on gets done. I move across, you know, 70 miles away to work on another site. The foreman there wants to make sure that I have reached the skill level I'm claiming I have so he can pay me the right thing. He's going to offer me a challenge and response sort of thing that,
yes,
I have to respond
exactly
to correctly. Which is why, and then, you know, this goes to there's vestige of this in the Mormon ceremony, why it was so important to not sell the signs or the tokens.
Yes.
Because if you did that, you would dilute the whole system.
Yes, exactly.
Because then any Yahoo could come in and cause problems.
Of course, you'd probably get in, start doing things, and they'd quickly notice that you just weren't qualified
to
be there.
Which it kind of begs the question. You know, you think you'd say, oh, okay, you're a journeyman. Well, go cut me that stone over.
Yeah.
it does seem a little bit overkill, but, you know, hey, it's pageantry.
Yeah. So we start in the 1400s. The first Masonic documents that come into existence that I would really call Masonic and related to our current documents today come into existence in 1425. And it turns out that right about that time, this was actually just a little bit after the Black Plague destroyed, you know, the population of Europe and England. And during that period of time, of course, with the, you had a whole lot of peasants and a lot of working class and, you know, people like stonemasons and carpenters, the skilled labor also were hit pretty heavily. Now, of course, the kings and queens and princes and nobles were also hit just as heavily. But, of course, there was always someone's son that would move in. So there was always a nobility class that wanted stuff to be built. And the problem was that with the Black Plague streeping through and killing so many people, they always had these building projects, but there weren't as many Masons. And so the first Masonic documents are produced because they were starting to unionize, basically.
Hmm.
And the king and, you know, some of the higher nobles and the people that ran the city government got really mad because they were unionizing and now raising the prices. And so the king issued a decree that they could not meet anymore. So they couldn't have their meetings to unionize in effect. And the first Masonic documents are written in response to this. And what they do is they claim that around 900 AD, that there was a king by the name of Athelstan, and they claim that he gave them permission to meet. And that's the first Masonic document. And it also lists a whole bunch of rules that governed the interaction between the masters, those that, you know, could hire and train entered apprentices, and the fellow craft, which were basically the journeymen. And it outlines the rules that would interact between these two main groups, the entered apprentice and the fellow crafts, the journeymen, and the masters of the lodge. And at that point, those got dictated. And those documents and those rules have actually continued in various forms up to our current time. It also lists a very, and I told you I'd talk a little bit about the history and the mythos of Masonry. It actually contains a short section claiming the history of the guild. And one of the things it says is it actually takes Masonry all the way back to Pythagoras. And it says that Pythagoras, while he was in Egypt, was the first person that instituted Freemasonry, and that, you know, they have this ancient lineage all the way back to Egypt. And that is a, you know, very interesting, you know, lineage, but, you know, it's totally fake.
Well, you know, the Egyptians, I read a book a couple years ago on the history of mathematics, and the Egyptians, they theorized, developed geometry because the Nile would wash out all their landmarkers, and they had put them in place. But the Pythagoreans, for them, geometry and mathematics and religion were completely inseparable.
Oh, yes, they most definitely were.
So if you're looking for that kind of jacked up language.
Oh, this was perfect language.
Yeah,
no,
and for, of course, Masons, that all that geometric stuff is part of their trade. So
yeah,
it just makes that perfect
it
convergence.
Makes a wonder, but there's no genetic connection.
Right.
Well, I guess there's no real genetic connection.
Other
I guess
than
you can
they
say,
can read it. You know.
That, yeah, other than both of them use geometry in their work. So in 1450, there's another unionization scandal, and there's a new document that's produced, and it expands greatly on the history. And it says not only was Egypt, did Masonry no longer started in Egypt, but it actually started with Cain. Because, you know, if you read in the Bible, who is the first person that orders the building of a city? Well, that's Cain, who orders a city made by his sons, which becomes the city of his, that's named after his son, Enoch. And so they claimed that. They claimed that after the flood, Nimrod, what, since, you know, he built the Tower of Babel, you know, he also must be a Mason.
Right. Obviously, yeah.
So you can see how, you know, you start out with one thing and then you start to add on to the history and you include biblical references and all of these type of things. So that's kind of how the mythos begins to build.
Well, and there's a huge history of pseudepigraphy. I can never say that word.
Pseudepigrapha,
which is basically people who take gaps in the Bible and write sort of fan fiction for sort of fill in the gaps.
Yeah.
And there's a long history, and you know, Joseph was he liked that sort of stuff too. So it can jack up your story a lot if you can connect in these points and people can see that, because the Bible is sort of the foundation, accept it, and then you build right on top of that. It's an obvious storytelling device.
Well, and even stuff, many things within the Bible itself are clearly pseudepigraphy themselves. Yeah. So,
and you know, probably even the original documents are just riffs on some other documents.
Oh,
somewhere
yeah,
out
most
there,
definitely.
You know, because we don't have the original. You know, if you look at the timeline of the Bible, we don't have the documents that match that timeline. They're obviously copies from generations later. So.
So now we're up to about 1450. You get because this ploy actually to some extent works to get around the king's banning of the trade unions. These documents get copied and spread throughout England, Britain, and Ireland, and they kind of become like the standard, you know, set of rules and the standard history for all of the Masonic guilds around that area. But at that point, you're really looking, these things look like other standard guilds. Now, they do have an initiation ceremony. Two of them, in fact. One when you become an entered apprentice and one when you become a journeyman or what's called a fellow of the craft or a fellow craft. They are very, very simple, though. For all intents and purposes, you can... They look like fraternity hazings. The guy comes in. They strap a blindfold. In Freemasonry, it's called a hoodwink over them. They'll actually probably throw a rope around their neck. And they will walk them into the lodge. And they will walk them around an altar. And while they're walking around, all the guys will jump out, go boo, boo, you know, and try to scare them as they go around. And then they will, you know, sit them down, have them say a prayer. They'll take them to the altar, and then they will put them under what's known as an obligation. And that obligation was very simple in those days. It was basically, you know, the rules were for an inner apprentice. Things like, you know, you won't sell the trade secrets, that you will stay away from the master's daughters and wife.
You're still talking about like the original. We're not up to the more
no,
modern.
No. We're really talking, you know, the 14, 15, 1600s.
Because one of the ideas that I understand in Masonry, although it's sort of not a very well kept secret, is that you wouldn't necessarily know what was next. You know, if you're an entered apprentice, you don't necessarily know that there are masters. It was that knowledge was at least the way I understand the ceremony. I don't think anybody actually is that way. So my understanding is like when you were hoodwinked and came in, that was your first introduction to the lodge. You would be disoriented, maybe not know. But if it's the guild, you would obviously know that the lodge existed, you know.
Well, I can understand your thought process there. Having actually gone through it, I'm not sure that's true because, you know, I knew all the guys in the lodge before I joined the lodge. You know, we would go out I'd go to their picnics. I would, you know, go out to dinner with them. And in fact, most lodges, you have to have recommendations in order to get into the lodge. And so obviously somebody signed your petition, and they've come to visit you. You're going to know that there's different levels, you know, because they'll say, hi, my name's so-and-so, I'm a Master Mason.
Well, that's one of the things that, like, the conspiracy theorists jump on with, like, higher levels, like 33rd degrees or whatever,
yes.
Because they would say, well, you wouldn't know. And if you did know, you wouldn't say it, you know.
That, yeah, it's just that conspiracy theory talk.
Well, my general thing about conspiracy theories is really human beings are very bad at keeping secrets. So I don't believe anything that involves a lot of secrecy, you know, like the moon landing. You start figuring out how many people would have to be in on it, and you're like,
yeah,
it's impossible. It's we can't impossible. Keep a secret for 6 hours in Washington. So
yeah.
All right. Forward.
Okay. So, like I said, during that period, we're really looking at very, very, you know, kind of a general kind of hazing, as well as an obligation to, you know, mind the rules of the craft. Things begin to change a little bit in the kind of late 1500s, early 1600s in Scotland. There's a new guy who comes and takes over the general the craft mm-hmm. of masonry, a guy by the name of William Shaw. And he does introduce some interesting changes into the craft. One of the things that he does is he introduces something known as the Mason's Word. And it's a secret within masonry, which is Shaw claims that and subsequent Masons actually claim that it is related to the sacred name of God. So in Hebrew, there's the Shem Hamforesh. The Shem is just name. Hamforesh is, you don't speak of it. You know, it's the unpronounceable name of God. And it looks like he may have, at that point, began to start claiming that the Masons had this secret. Why? We're not really sure why he instituted this. But there, he does institute some other things. One of them is called my mind's just going blank here. He institutes a program amongst the Masons where they have to memorize stuff in order to prove every year that they are, you know, an interapprentice or a fellow craft or a fellow craft. And so it's really at that point that you begin to have this type of memory work mm-hmm. that is required. And it's usually what it looks like. It was a recitation of the history and a recitation of, you know, the keywords, the passwords and those type of thing, as well as potentially some, you know, geometry principles.
But at this time, we're still attached to the
we're
Mason,
still very
the
much Mason attached guild. To the Masonic guilds. And in response to this, because they're now being tested on a yearly basis, the Masons start introducing what in their day was the best way of memorizing material. And that was they started to devise the idea of that they started teaching in the form of a catechism. Mm. And so, you know, I would say, well, what is, you know, who invented this? And you would say, well, he invented this in such and such a date, and he knew so and so and so and so. And, you know, it's this type of catechism that was right. very common in, you know, the Catholic Church and later on in the Anglican Church. And so this form of question answer session, which of course shows up in the endowment as well, is actually not in existence in Masonry until, you know, the 1600s in Scotland.
Okay.
And so, you know, you can start to see how there's these different elements that are building up over time. Also in Scotland and then more also in England within the beginning to mid to late 1600s, you also start having regular non-operative Masons or scholars, people that are interested in the things that are taught within the Masonic guilds. They start joining the Masonic guilds. And the reason for that is actually fairly complicated. Turns out that during that time period, if you were an educated, scholarly person, one of the things you needed to learn was geometry. You needed to know math. But also, there was a couple of characters that got added to the Masonic history, such as Pythagoras, okay, that drew these men into the guilds. And so you start having, through this time period, a whole series of non-operative Masons joining the guilds and becoming involved and learning these principles of geometry and things. And so throughout the latter bit of the 1600s into the early 1700s, you actually start having a number of guilds or of Masonic lodges that are entirely made up of antiquarians, sometimes noblemen, scholars that are now meeting in the guilds or in the lodges and now have their own lodges. And so that really brings us into England in right around 1717, when there's a number of these lodges that join together and they form what's known as the first Grand Lodge. And they dictate that any lodge that forms after that has to get permission from them.
So now these lodges, they would have to have a space, like, you know, and I understand they would oftentimes be like above pubs and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So how secretive was it really? I mean, did people know what was going on, or was it underground? It just seems like, you know, to my old statement a few minutes ago, it'd be really hard to keep this on the down low.
Oh, yes. And in fact, you start having Masonic exposés really early. You actually have people noticing that these things are starting to happen. And it's not – it's you know, within a couple of years, what's going on in these things mm-hmm. is pretty much known. Now, there are some interesting aspects about this. As these antiquarians came in, and scholars and stuff, these men were very well trained in, you know, mathematics. Many of them were very interested in things like alchemy.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that was very popular at that time amongst the scholarly educated class was a form of Jewish mysticism known as Kabbalah, which many of the religionists were beginning to adapt a kind of Christian version of this. And so they actually bring with them these, you know, interest in alchemy and these type of things. And they begin to take the Masonic ritual and slightly tweak it and add some of these elements to give the ritual itself a little bit more symbolic meaning. But there were other reasons for this transition as well. One of them was, and why this actually happened in England is probably, at least to some extent, due to the fact that you have the Great Fire in England, which destroys everything. You then have a huge number of operative Masons that move into England and, you know, they form their own lodges and et cetera. Well, then after everything's built, some of them have their own, you know, lodge buildings and, you know, things, and they don't have anybody to fill them. Because now all the operative Masons are beginning to move off onto other projects. And so they're more than willing to start, you know, having these upper class gentlemen mm-hmm. who want a place of their own where they can meet, where especially religion is not a subject, you know, because during this time you have the Catholics and the Protestants, you know, battling it out in England. And so this is a place where men of intelligence can meet behind closed doors, discuss things, share scholarly interests, but yeah, you know, they're kind of they can do that outside of the purview and the eye of others.
Well, and if you think about it, I mean, there's no TV. There's theater, but you know, it's got its ups and downs. And they were kind of skanky places. you know, if you had a book at the time, it was probably the Bible. You know,
The big thing that's happening in these guilds, they're eating and they're drinking. These are really dinner clubs, where you can go and talk to intelligent people.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, this is entertainment.